it's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine and I'm now joined by a happy Sab Stafford Bloor.
I am happy. Thank you, Joe.
And a less happy JJ Bull.
Yes.
Hello there. How are you?
Yeah, fine. Good.
Difficult result to take on a difficult evening.
I really thought we might have won today. And that was... I should have known that was never going to happen. Why didn't I know?
The thing is, though, you've got to wear your heart on your sleeve and be vulnerable. Otherwise, you'll never love.
I know, but then it's easier to be numb and neutral all the time. And then that way you don't have to deal with being happy or sad.
It's easier in these moments. Yeah. But then you wouldn't experience the joy of Scotland eventually winning the World Cup in 2040.
Yeah.
There we go.
You know what's interesting, Jay? Like, even despondent, unhappy JJ is about 900% more fun than Alex.
What's Alex like when his team loses?
Alex is numb all the time.
This is very neutral. This is very neutral. JJ's smiling, and that's
Alex will get angry in moments when his team does something bad, but afterwards it's like nothing ever happened.
Mm. He glares at us sometimes, but also the television.
Well, anyway, welcome to the podcast. We're going to be talking about England today and how England progressed through the group in first place. Possibly a mistake. We'll come to talk about that a bit later. Now that Croatia have finished second, of course, I think they're going to make it further than we will. We're also going to talk to JJ about what happened in the Scotland-Croatia game. Seb and I haven't seen that, and I imagine some of the many people, I suppose, listening to the podcast probably won't have seen it either. So we'll get the lowdown from JJ a bit later. And then later on, we'll come to talk about UEFA again and the situation around the Alliance Arena. So that's going to be fun and exciting for
us. Yeah, sure is.
But you know what else is fun and exciting for us and other people?
Is it the Athletic?
It is the Athletic. It really, and you know, I think I've had one of the most fun reading the Athletic days of all time today. Do you know why?
Tell me about it.
Because Yaya Toure wrote an amazing article about why bums are so important in football. And I really, really loved it. And you know what? It's analysis I've never seen before.
Tell me more about it, please.
Well, it was just about the use of the bum and how a smaller player... So, for example, there's a line in the article about how, like, Eden Hazard has almost become... It's almost become kind of a meme that he's got quite a big bum, Eden Hazard, as he's running. Or at least he runs with his bum in a sort of strange way. And Yaya Toure points out that it's totally crucial to the way that he plays football. Yeah. He's quite short, but he's got a low centre of gravity. And he's able to hold off multiple people with his bum, pushing his bum out, you know? It's great. I guess I kind of knew that backing into people. But the way that Yaya Toure has put it, it's lovely. So if you want to read that, you should visit theathletic.com/TIFO. And you can do so by getting a 30-day free trial. So if you want, you can read that and then cancel it and never come back. But you won't want to do that because it's very, very good for a long time. For a long time. So visit theathletic.com/TIFO. Anyway, we are going to move on now, get to grips with this today's episode. Some joy, some misery, and hopefully some middle stuff in the middle as well. And it's all going to be lovely. So I will leave you in the warm hands and the cool embrace of Seb Stafford Bloor and JJ Bull the Bullet. Okay, let's begin with England 1-0 Czech Republic. This was an interesting game to watch. And Seb, it started like a game that I thought was going to give me my 5-0 predicted. And then I remembered the same thing kind of happened in the Croatia game and to a slightly less exaggerated extent happened in the Scotland game as well, minus all of the goals. But I'm wondering now if this is a game management thing because it felt like very strong out of the gates. Sterling had that chance at the beginning where he hit the post. Mm-hmm. And for the first 15-20 minutes, England looked like they were right up for it, well on top of the game, incisive passes through the middle, not quite gung-ho, but you know they looked like they were going to score goals. They got their goal, of course. But then in the middle of each half, there's just a big lull. And it's slightly different in the second half. Is this a game management thing, do you think? Because it seems very similar in all three of the games so far.
It has done. And actually, it was so positive for those first 15 minutes. You stood up and shouted, it's going to be 5-0 yes. at one point.
Yes, I did do that.
It's hard to say because you. It feels as if...
It should have been.
I felt like England had the chance. If England had stayed in that gear, which was kind of, say, fourth or fifth gear, Czechs look really vulnerable because I think the difference between this game and the game against Scotland was just the intensity of those front four players.
Yeah.
One of the things that really surprised me was that great to see Jack Grealish playing, but with Grealish, you kind of expect a little bit of a luxury item, someone that's going to be, you know, predominantly effective with the ball. But he was really intense. I'd love to see the number of pressures he managed in, you know, the first half. But yeah, and then they drop back down the gears, and I don't know. Like it's. I think the tournament will prove this one way or the other. I mean, it's certainly a pattern that they shared with the Croatia game. But at the same time, it also felt as if the balance got slightly wrong because. Yes, the intensity dropped a little bit, but there was no counter-attacking threat, really, after about 25 minutes, or none that I remember, which felt like a failing, because ordinarily you'd expect, right, drop into a sort of a lower block, compact the middle of the pitch, and then use your wide players to spring out of defence. And that didn't really happen, which made me think that it was partly game management, possibly, but maybe also a little bit of a loss of control.
I think the second half was game management. I mean, we can come on to talk about the systems used and the way that impacted the game, but... Bringing Henderson on, it really felt like England wanted to control the ball a little bit more, because I think it's, in some ways, when I said it should have been 5-0, that's probably a little bit unfair to the Czechs. It should have been 5-2 or 5-3, or, you know, they definitely had their chances, and England looked a little bit shaky at times.
Yeah, Sajak had that that snapshot on the edge of the box, which might have been ruled out because of the high foot on Luke Shaw, possibly. Mm-hmm. But there were moments, and Jordan Pickford had that sort of nervy... double-fisted punch where it looked like he kind of jumped a little bit too early. So yeah, I don't think England were that convincing. I thought they were a little bit fragile in the middle. And I, on the one hand, great to get Henderson on pitch because he's going to be useful and you need players to play when they're coming back from injury.
Scored his offside goal too.
Scored his offside goal, absolutely, which was nice. Also, he played quite well. He the chance he created for, I think it was...
Kane.
For Kane, that caught your eye. And so that was good. But I felt as if the change in balance in that England midfield disrupted things a little bit because it went from Rice and Phillips to Henderson and Phillips. And it seemed as if Phillips then took on the deeper role, dropping back with the centre-halves and taking the ball off them. And Henderson was more of a kind of a tweener, a shuttling type of player. And it seemed to disrupt England a little bit. But you can't really criticise it, can you? They got away with it. They got through. The Czechs had moments. I would never say they were particularly dangerous. I never felt anxious.
Sure.
I mean, even for me, you know what I'm like at the end of games with, you know, the hands on the head and the anxiety and the shouting and the jumping and all that stuff. And
yeah, you looked anxious.
But I didn't really go to that next stage of there was no swearing or shouting at the TV. Mm-hmm. There was no, you know, there was none of that.
Of course, you've already pulled all of your hair out, so
I don't have any more to lose.
Exactly.
Exactly that. So we kind of, in a way, I win.
Seb Stafford Blanc. You know, nothing to lose. Let's talk about the different setups here too, because one of the things that was nice about seeing Jack Grealish start the game, and we should mention, I mean, we've no idea what Gareth Southgate would have done in a different scenario, but of course Mason Mount was unavailable for selection as he was self-isolating, so it kind of forced Southgate's hand a little bit, you would imagine. It was quite nice to see Jack Grealish starting there, but it completely changed the setup. For only a small tweak, it felt very different in that first half before Grealish came off, because they had him in that free 10 role. Kane was extremely deep at times.
Yep.
The two wingers were slightly more disciplined in their role, so it wasn't entirely fluid. But it felt like Grealish was more separate from Phillips and Rice. Phillips, who stayed a lot deeper in this game than Mount has been in the previous games. It looked like, if not an entirely different England, like quite a different approach based on what we've seen previously.
Yeah, you pointed this out, because in the beginning of the game, I thought it was more of a midfield three with Grealish at the tip of that sort of unit. In reality, Don, our producer, looked this up at half-time, and whilst sort of Saka and Sterling were playing from their respective sides inwards, Grealish and Kane were really the ones that were swapping vertical roles. That was very interesting. We've talked about his pressing, which is Another fascinating point, actually, because it was at times it was Jack Grealish doing his best Mason Mount impression.
Yeah.
Because that's what you associate with Mount alongside what he does with the ball. He is an aggressive presser.
And discipline, right?
Yeah, discipline. Just a more sort of, more of a stable player, whereas Grealish is a little bit more schemey, a little bit chaotic. What was really encouraging, though, and we criticised England for this after the Scotland game, is they never got close to that pocket of space in front of the box.
Yeah.
And I looked up the touch map at the end of the game, after Jack Grealish went off, and it's littered with little touches just to the left of the D in exactly the area that you want him. Because
give me the numbers, Seb.
Don't have the numbers. I just have a little chart which I can describe.
What, Grealish's numbers?
I don't have his statistics.
Oh, you've written them down here.
Have I indeed?
You said that only 9 of his 37 touches were in England's half. 15.
Oh, I see.
I mean, in
the position they were, yes. So
I'm sorry.
37 touches altogether, 9 in his own half, which is great. Means England were playing high. And 15 of those, approximately, don't quote me on that because I had to estimate it, were in the final third. And the point I'm trying to make is that they're in the area where you want Jack Grealish, which is to the left of that D, because he can cut inside and he can shoot potentially or loft the ball to that post, which is good often. Suck defenders in, slip the ball across, create a shooting opportunity. Or he's good enough to kind of carve into the penalty box down that left-hand side or find somebody on the overlap, which is kind of how the first goal came in, was scored. And it was great. And I said to you, actually, I think probably just before half-time, wouldn't it be terribly unfair if Mason Mount lost his England place because of Billy Gilmour?
Yeah.
But I think Grealish this evening played a role that a lot of people haven't thought he was able to fill.
Yeah.
Probably including Gareth Southgate, because if you remember, it seems a long time ago now, but Southgate took a long, long time to trust Grealish and to think that he was worth even experimenting with in a squad.
Well, you can see the difference too, right? And that's because, you know, the main difference here in this game being that Calvin Phillips is clearly a lot deeper in this game. And he's obviously been, that's his remit. He's been told, don't push up as much.
You don't have to.
Because Grealish is ahead of you.
Exactly.
Yeah. I guess that is an indication of maybe what Gareth Southgate trusts those two different players to do. Let's have that comparison now, though, right? Because we're going into the round of 16. We don't know who's going to finish second in Group F, but it could be anyone. It could be anyone, technically. I have a dreadful feeling it's going to be France.
It's going to be France,
Against France, presumably you want Mount to play.
I don't know.
Or do you need, like, what I saw from Grealish today were those... Here's my main point on the comparison between the two of them, right? And this is not a tactical point, and Alex would slap me on the wrist if he was here when I was saying this, but the opposition defenders are afraid of Grealish. Yeah. And you can see it, and it changes the way that they play. It changes the way that they react to him having the ball, and it creates chaos. And whether that amounts to anything or not, you can... like, they're just not... It's not. This is not a criticism of the way that Mason Mount plays. They're just not afraid of him in the same way that they're afraid of Jack Grealish. And that gives me, I don't know, it gives me something.
Yeah, it gives you something to hang a hat on. I think the difference is, and I think Mason Mount is a lovely player. I think he's fabulously talented and in ways that he's not given credit for. He actually has quite a lot of flair. It's just not in the same way that Grealish does.
Yeah.
I think
he has smaller thighs.
Yeah, he does.
And calves.
Yeah.
Different and legs
hair.
Overall.
Different hair.
Yeah.
I think I see Mount more as a system player, as a component, whereas Grealish, I think he's not quite a sort of a free roll, freewheeling, do what he likes kind of player, but there is that element where you think if you place him, if you put him in a side in that position, you have to build some compensations around him. But the trade-off is... he can win you the game.
Do you know what he is? He's the star of the show in a game where Sterling and Saka were the stars of the show. Do you know what I'm saying? He never stops being the star of the show, even if he isn't actually the star.
I think some of it's latent, though, because there's this excitement. There's a kind of residual excitement in having Jack Grealish on the pitch, because you think he could do something. Like, he may not do now, but every time he gets the ball at his feet, you watch. And there aren't that many players in English football like that. Who just command your attention in that way, and I say this kind of not in a, you know, as a judgment as to who should be playing for England. I just prefer watching Grealish. He entertains me more. He's more my kind of player, I think. But I'd say, look, if it is France, I think we can assume Mount will play, just because I think Southgate will trust Mount to work without the ball better, even despite what we've seen tonight. I think it's...
I think he would technically finish his isolation the day before the game, though, right?
It's difficult. I don't know how much we... talking now, we don't know how much training they're allowed to do, or whether it is literal isolation, or whether there's the possibility to get them running and to keep them fit, because that seems, I mean, if they have 10 days off, that's the end of a tournament, because you can't recover fitness.
Presumably, it's a wonder if he's at home.
I have no idea. I mean, this describes the situation, though.
Yeah, we don't know.
Baffling. Okay. It's very, very strange. But
in which case, then let's be a little bit more theoretical. I want to bring JJ into the conversation just briefly. I know you didn't see this game, JJ, but if you were asked to choose between starting Jack Grealish or Mason Mount, knowing what they might bring differently to a game, and let's assume that whoever we face in the next round, England, I should say, whoever England face in the next round, they're going to be a difficult opponent, given that they're coming out of Group F. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, they're although they play sort of similar positions.
I thought there was a real chance players. You might just say, "I don't care."
That's the obvious joke. I'm going to go for more subtle ones than that. I think the thing with Mount is I think he creates things kind of two passes before. Like his numbers never huge for goals and assists, right? But he creates things a couple of passes before. Before the finishing move, whereas Grealish is the guy usually at the end of it, the second, the actual assist, or the guy in the end of it.
He's visible.
And also Grealish will, the reason defenders are scared of him is because he'll run directly at them, because he's confident he'll go past them, and often does, or he just goes through them. Yeah. Whereas Mount, I think if he's running towards people, he'll run away from them into space. So like they'll show him away and he'll go there and then he'll play a pass. So Mount sort of gives you better protection against good teams, like France, because he's going to be deeper when he makes those runs, and I think he works far better in the press. He just seems to have more aware of it. Not that Grealish isn't, because it's easy to write off players who look as skillful and elegant as Grealish and just assume they don't work. They all do, but some just have this little bit in them, a bit of anger that helps them, and maybe just tactical discipline and just being quite in tune with the game. So I think a team like that, you play Mount, but I mean you can play. I think Celtic is being so conservative with it, probably rightly, because it's a cup. It's so boring to watch as neutral. Like, I know Portugal they hold themselves in, but England were awful against Scotland, dreadful. And everyone's talking about how good Scotland were. It's because England were bad. And then you have, I obviously didn't see this game, but I mean, 1-0 Czech Republic, who are a lot better than I think we've seemed to have thought they would be. But maybe that's just game management and maybe changing bits in the midfield is to try and control the game rather than let them come at them. But you can play Grealish as an eight and get him forward. You can have Phillips behind them and hold it. You can put your fullbacks up. Like the way Italy are playing, they're really aggressive. Surely enough, you're going to leave yourself open to counterattacks especially. But they could just do so much more. You can play Foden wide left. You can have Sancho on the right. You can have Kane there. I mean, Sterling scored again. So you have him in there. Rashford came in for him, didn't he? And just played the left.
Yeah, I think so.
Minimal touches.
Jadon Sancho came on for the last sort of 8 or 9 minutes as well.
That's good. Yeah. Yeah, one of the best players in the world for 8 minutes, so you need. So you have Calvin Phillips, right? And you're saying he was playing deep, but his touch map shows that he was, well, especially early on, it seems to be, he was getting forward to the right. And it's his pass from the right wing that kind of sets the move up for the goal that Sterling plays. And then you see Grealish should swap with Sterling, because Sterling's gone as a centre-forward position next to Kane for that goal, and then Grealish sort of holds back next to him. But rather than going wide left, like Sterling might, he gets in amongst it in the kind of 10 slot, which is how he's able to then win the header and then get on the ball to come back into it. I think if you're, we'll probably come into this with Scotland, if you're a bit braver with your selection and play more of your attacking players and you push, you actually are more defensively sound sometimes because you push the other opposition back.
Yeah.
Like if you don't take the risks, you don't get any rewards. It's very obvious to say, but
it's kind of what we were saying last night, though, isn't it? Because it's this choice between letting the opposition worry about what you have at the top of your formation versus, let's make a selection which is focused on what we're going to face. And I feel like the longer you go into a tournament, the more of a problem that will ultimately become. I always think back to that 2018 World Cup semi-final and the kind of substitutions that were made in that game and what England might have achieved from a winning position. And it was almost as if they got to 1-0, they scored the free kick, and they thought, oh my goodness, we might be in a World Cup final in a few days. Let's hold this. Let's just, on comes Eric Dier. You know, it's a thing that Southgate has to get rid of. It has to get over, because I think there comes a point where if you want to win games that actually matter beyond just group stages and games you're expected to win, you have to be brave enough to make a decision which might make you look silly.
I don't agree.
No?
I don't agree. They got to the semi... I know I said this yesterday,
but do you think
they got
they're
to
good
the semi-finals in the World Cup playing that way. I know it's boring, and I agree with that. Like, I would... All I want to see watching the game tonight is just to watch them be unshackled.
If they played one good team before they got to that semi, they would have not reached the semi.
Colombia were a good team.
I felt like... Colombia were a good team, but Quintero wasn't there. James Rodriguez wasn't there. Colombia were the best team England faced, definitely. And I got a bit annoyed with the kind of haven't faced anybody. It's like, well, so? You know, that annoyed me too during the World Cup. But at the same time, like, you got to feel like tournaments reward bold decisions. And I want to see what England can do. I want to see England...
I just don't feel like that, though. And I don't think the evidence shows that that's the case either.
But I tell you what, like, okay, put it this way. If England... The thing is, if England remain conservative and focus on what they can stop an opponent doing, do you trust the defence to hold?
I'm not saying that I do. No. I'm just saying that it is as legitimate, if not more a legitimate tactic than doing the opposite of that. We've seen so many winners of the Euros and of the World Cup playing in precisely this conservative way. We know that international football is slightly more conservative. When we talk about the game management stuff, it's managing, you know, players' exhaustion over a short period of time where there's lots of games. Again, I say, really wanting not to repeat myself from yesterday, haven't conceded a goal. They haven't conceded a goal yet. They played Croatia, who are not a terrible team. They've beaten Scotland by 3-1 this evening, right? They've got great players in their team. That even Perisic has, apart from his lovely little chest back to the goalkeeper in the second game, scored a fantastic goal. We saw Modric as a goal. We'll come on to talk about that this evening. It's a fantastic goal, right? The Czech Republic put 2 past Scotland as well. We know that they have players who can take those shots as well. Again, Scotland are no slouches either. So they haven't conceded a goal. I know it's boring.
I don't mind the boring
They're through on 7 points top of the group, right?
It's not that...
Why wouldn't I trust the defence?
I think because if you look back at the teams that, you're quite right, like, international football is quite conservative. If you look back at the teams that have prospered playing that way, you find probably a better standard of goalkeeper, better fullbacks.
Greece. We're talking about
Greece.
I mean,
that is a long time ago, though. Like, that's...
it's
nearly 20 years ago. Like, it's
Portugal had a better back line than England do and a better goalkeeper than England do.
I think they also...
4 years ago? 5 years ago now?
I would say so, yeah.
I don't agree. And
I might be being negative about England.
But I think, like, I find it weird that we're having a conversation about whether we trust the defence or not when they've gone through the group stages without conceding a goal.
I suppose it comes down to, have England faced not even an elite centre-forward, an 8 out of 10 centre-forward. I think Patrick Schick is kind of heading in that direction. But this is the kind of the curse. Like, if you watch enough England tournament efforts,
I know
you invariably worry, and I might
after
very
trauma.
Well be,
I get
but
it.
I might well be. This might just be a kind of a manifestation of just the wounds that I've carried over the years. But it just, like, I think back to Germany 2014. You have, like, a lot of really good players in the defensive, on the sort of the other side of the ball, in their primes. 2018, probably the same thing, I would say, with France. Like, if you look at, they had a lot of other things too, of course, but they just seem stronger than England. Whereas I look at where the strength of this England side is and the kind of this array, JJ mentioned it, the array of different attacking options and the quality and the goals that could come out of it. And you think, if I have to pick a way forward that makes me feel a little less worried, it's that one. It can be, if England were to win a European championship, bore me to death, I couldn't care less. Fantastic. It's just about...
Well, what I've seen in this England is that they can't really go up gears or anything. They just sort of play constantly in this 2 or 3. Maybe that's manager's thing, but I think the best teams can go through it and they read the game. That's part of management, where you come and go. And it's not just like the defence is what you, like, you don't trust the defence. It's the entire team. And Southgate wants the entire team to be this rigid, not necessarily conservative, but, like, you might win the game if you don't concede. Like, you've more chance. It's the Mourinho style of thinking. Like, the team who makes the most mistakes is the one that's going to lose.
Yeah.
So you need to be able to take advantage of that. If you want to play in the counter, you've got pace to do it. You've got players like Kane who will... So bad teams play like that, on, you know, conservatively and defensively, to make sure there's no holes and gaps so they can't get cut open. And they often win games that they shouldn't win. If you have great players and do the same thing, then you've got a far better advantage or chance of winning, because in theory your players are much better going forward, so you should be able to score more.
Yeah.
So I see exactly the logic behind it. It just sucks. They've got so much better players than what Scotland have. I know, and it's
boring to watch at times as well. But we started this conversation by talking about game management, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And England are yet to be a goal behind in this tournament, right? England are yet to desperately need to score a goal. I know that the Scotland game was boring 0-0, right? They didn't need to score a goal. They were effectively qualified after drawing that game. We're yet to see what Southgate's response to a dire scenario is. If we do face France in the round of 16 and you go a goal down in the first or the second half, I think we'll see England play a different way. And we know that based on how they've come out in the first 5-10 minutes of each game, firing on all cylinders, trying to get that early chance. In two of the games, we've hit the post in the first 5 or 10 minutes, right? And it seems to me that what Southgate wants to do is get a goal early and then manage the game. And if that works, why not?
I hope you're right. I hope you're right. I just worry about what happens if they were to fall behind to a France or to a Germany. That would worry me just because it feels like England don't create a lot of good chances. They have a lot of possession. And they have a lot of opportunities to create chances, but they don't necessarily create a lot of chances themselves. And when you're not creating those chances against, with the greatest respect, a kind of second tier group of nations, really, Croatia aside, that's just a bit concerning. It just suggests that maybe, I'm not one of those people that thinks, right, well, you know, we should win every game in that group 5-0. And, you know, well, you actually literally,
how dare
literally
you?
Thought that, didn't you?
How dare you?
But I don't know. I can't help but feel slightly disappointed. I'm delighted that England threw. Can't wait for the knockout rounds. Absolutely.
Listen to him, JJ. Huh? Your team's out tonight. He's got 7 points and they haven't conceded a goal and he's disappointed.
Hey, Thomas Green wants to talk about Saka because he was brilliant. Yes, he was.
Yeah,
Thomas
we will talk about Saka, but we need to go to a break first. Okay. So we will be back after this. We're back! And we're going to talk about Saka because he was really good, Seb.
Yeah, very, very impressed. We actually, a while ago, do you remember when we had James McNicholas on the podcast when it was during the COVID lockdown, so we weren't videoing it. We were talking about...
Jimmy
McNicky.
Top dog.
Very good man. There's actually a poster of him at the Old Red Lion. Did you know that?
Yes, there is.
Every time I go into the flat, and it's usually about 12 o'clock, 12:30, I open the door, turn the light on, and there's this massive picture of James McNicholas. It scares the hell out of me every night.
We should clarify that he was acting in a show that performed there, and that's why Uncle Damien doesn't just have a random photo of James McNicholas in his pub.
Is it the boxer? Was that what it was for?
No, it was the...
He's wearing a top hat.
Can't remember.
Can't remember what it's
called.
Is
it The Importance of Being Earnest, perhaps?
Possibly. I'll take a picture of it later.
Anyway, never mind.
What was the question?
Saka.
Yeah. So I remember us talking to James about where his best position was because he was still operating between left back and left wing or sort of left midfield for Arsenal. And between the three of us, we talked about how effective he might be coming off the right because he's got the pace and the ability to go outside, but he's got that quality, which means that when he knifes in towards the box, he's a problem and he drags defenders with him. And I just thought he was great. I still want to see Jadon Sancho, but Saka was a really pleasant surprise tonight because I feel like he's one of those players that we all rate and we all think is going to be good. And then there's Arsenal's such a strange team that there's not a lot of substance to that. But I felt like this was a really mature performance.
I agree with that. I think I worry that when I saw the lineup, I instantly thought of it as a defensive lineup because of how well Saka has played in the wing-back roles for Arsenal, right? Of how mature those sort of defensive side of his performances have been. But that really, you know, not saying he didn't do well in that regard this evening, but he was such a threat going forward. I mean, I love to watch players that are that age particularly because... I know it's a bit of a cliche, but it's just no fear, is there? Every time he got the ball, just run past someone, then he would carry further and further and further. Five people passed after the point where we were shouting, pass it now!
Yeah,
he was still going with the ball, and it was great to watch.
He's kind of the opposite of me, so I'm talking about how wounded I am by past England experiences.
Sure.
Here's a guy that doesn't have any negative England experiences, and look at the benefit. Look at the benefit. He was great. He was he was so positive, I think. Take over before my voice goes. Please.
Yeah.
It's going.
The last thing I want to talk about with England is just to ask you, JJ, about the nice sort of the broad differences between the 4-3-3 and the 4-2-3-1. Because as we said, it was a little bit of a system change today. It felt like England played slightly differently in the first half. I would like to be, briefly schooled on what the sort of broad pros and cons are of that.
Well, I was just looking at how the, I mean, I've not seen the match, so to make that clear, but it looks like in the substitutions that the only real time they could probably have changed that to a three in the midfield was when Bellingham came on.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah.
Was that what it was? Yeah. So then you've got, well, then you've got, yeah, you have greater control of the midfield. Sounds quite obvious, but it means you've got someone who can sit deep in front of the defence. So you suddenly have like a, you can create a diamond straight away from the back two, or a triangle back two to the six, which I must assume must have been Phillips dropped in because Rice went off.
Yes.
Then you get Henderson on the other side of him, who's nice and busy. I mean, it's not, it's often, it just suits the players you've got in. So you want to put Bellingham in midfield and get Grealish off. It's going to be not necessarily just to change the system, but just because that you want that player on. And you play Bellingham, he's box to box. So we can do that. Grealish, you want him in more advanced places. You want him to receive the ball in the final third and turn, whereas you want Bellingham to get him a bit deeper because he can drive and that carries you forward in a different way. It might mean if you have the 10 that, because Crit Republic always play with a double pivot. It's always Socek and his other boy, Holes, is it? He's there. So that's, they can sort of keep Grealish quiet, which then means there's space if you're playing a 4-2-3-1 for other people to get into, but they're mostly have to sit deep. So Phillips from touch maps looks like he was getting wide right sometimes, which is again going to leave you a big space in the middle of the pitch for Rice to cover all on his own. So if you have a three rather than a two, you've got greater coverage defensively because you're covering both half spaces and your six position. And you say it might invite teams out slightly more because you don't have the 10 there. So that's one thing. There's that space behind the striker is gone. But when you remove this, the player from... So everyone says, oh, we need a 10 in our team. But actually, most teams play with two tens, and that's what Sterling and Saka are sort of meant to have been.
Right.
Because by leaving the space vacant, but not having a 10 there, they can move into it. If you play with a 10, then the idea should be they rotate and the other guys can move in, but the space is still there. So there's a good chance there'll be a defender marking that space. So, I mean, I always like teams that play with a 4-3-3, just because I don't know, it just makes kind of a lot of sense to me. If you have the player positioned there, normally, I mean, the most... what's the word I'm looking for? Not stereotypical, but like archetypal 10 I can think of off the top of my head is like Riquelme.
Yeah.
Stand like a trick artista.
Yeah,
it was just stand still and play like he's a pivot. So rather than your pivot being at the base of the midfield where you play passes around, you have the pivot behind the striker and he would just stand still. Like, I don't know how to make a career out of it and get around it that way.
JJ, when you like, one of the things that fascinates me is that rotation at the top of formation. Like, you've got your coaching qualifications. How difficult is that to teach? Because like, presumably it involves a lot of timing, a lot of practice, a lot of drilling. Like, how do you get players to do that in an effective way?
At an elite level, I have no idea.
But like, if I wanted to coach an amateur team, like, what am I telling players to do? Is it just a question of, right, you stand there, or you're moving here when the ball is over there? How do you even begin to do it?
Heap of different ways. So I think if we're talking about, so what I know of this sort of level or any level, right, we're talking about, so say you've got staff that you can help you with, you'd show them what you want on a video or some paper, show them what you want, or on the training pitch, you'd be playing a game. Most coaching is done in small-sided games, so you don't play 11v11, you play 4v4, 5v5, 7v7.
So it's department against department, really?
Not necessarily, but right. You'd have, you'd make a smaller pitch. So you see, you cut off the pitch, so you've got, you cut it in quadrants, say, and you're playing 4v4 in that area, and then you would get to a certain position, you're meant to be playing a diamond in this, and then you would blow your whistle, stop play, and say, this is what I want you to be able to do here, is this kind of thing. But what you often want to do is not tell someone exactly what you want. You want them to figure it out themselves. There's two different kinds of thinking. Well, there's probably many different kinds of thinking. If you just tell them, they might not know when to do it. If you help them learn themselves when to go and how to do it. It's all to do with timing, and then you'll get different sessions. We have individual one-on-one sessions with people just working just with them. And you'll do shaping sessions as well, which is what the team shape generally will look like here. And then what you don't want to do, I think, is remove too much freedom from players, especially in the final third. Because if you start telling them this is what you have to do here and then, opposite managers will figure it out, defenders will figure it out during the game. Like, that will happen. Like AI, they will figure it out and stop you. So if you want to encourage, I think, a bit of freedom, but you'll find with like Louis van Gaal's teams, for example, everything is controlled.
Yeah.
Everything, the movements, the rotations, when to go, where to go here. But good players just know when, and eventually it kind of works out. Mourinho's quite rigid as well, I think. And then Pep Guardiola is thought of as being very free-flowing, but it's also very highly structured. However, when they get into the final third, the structure is that the team has to have certain things, has to have width, has to have verticality, has to be at a certain tempo. These are the rigid parts of it. But players are, like, the rotations are there, but they are not told when to do it. They just know when to go and how to do it, which takes a lot of, I would imagine, repetition on the training ground to encourage freedom of thought, even though you're repeating the...
Would you say it's like the same difference between a director that encourages actors to stick to the script versus a director that enjoys a little bit of improvisation around the script?
I think that's exactly what I would say. I think it's very clever. Like It's Always Sunny rather than, like, I don't know.
Sure. Jam like it down his throat.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll be back after this short break to discuss Scotland. And we're back! And now it's time to enter the solemn part of this evening's podcast. JJ?
Hello!
Scotland won. 3 Croatia. Now, Seb and I haven't seen this, and perhaps some of the listeners haven't seen this either. Tell us what happened.
Croatia have really good players. Luka Modric he was unbelievable.
I saw that goal.
Yeah, but the way he controlled the entire game, honestly, it's, you can just tell that, like, we were talking on another podcast about certain players at, like, junior level are just so much better than, like, when you play 5-a-side with a pro, you're like, oh, right, I get it now. That's a different species of human to me.
Yeah.
At this international level, Modric was, different.
Now tell me, did Scotland...
A different meat, but that's not a different meat. That's not a saying.
Now tell me, did Scotland try to stop him from controlling the game?
Not in the ways you kind of hoped for, like kicking him, but didn't do any of that. Modric was... They tend to play... They play like a 3 normally in the midfield, and it was a 3, but they're playing it as a 2-1, Croatia. So rather than keeping Modric deep, and he was dropping deep... A lot of the time he was going into the 10 space because, as we've highlighted in one of our TIFO IRL preview videos, there's a lot of space that exists between the Scotland back 3 and the rest of the team. And he just got in there occasionally. And when he was able to get on the ball there, the midfield didn't squish quickly enough. And they're just, Croatia always has a player free. They just always had a player free. And as good as Croatia were, I think Scotland, we were talking about this earlier with England, I think Scotland weren't brave enough. And I think some of the team selection was wrong. I think the changes should be made sooner. I think Steve Clarke clearly knows a lot more than I do about everything in life. but I think, I wonder whether he might regret not making changes sooner. Like one example, Nathan Patterson came on in about the 80th minute, something like that, for Stephen O'Donnell when the game was gone. And immediately... It just turned the way Scotland were able to attack. Coincided with Croatia then sitting back a bit because the game was won, right?
Was it already 3-1 by that point?
It was, yeah. So you think, well, we'll just put him on. But, so he comes on straight away. And then one of the first things he does is inside his own box, he's been pressed and he fakes to clear it. And then does a little Cruyff turn, cuts back in, plays it short to Marshall, who has time because no one's pressing him anymore because I think he's going to boot it away. And Scotland are able to move up the pitch. Fraser runs towards goal. I think we almost get a chance out of it. Now, that is the difference. That's where you play out from the back. Because that little bit of calmness, bravery in possession is exactly how you turn defence into attack. Rather than just humping it up the pitch, which is what they kept doing towards Dykes, who didn't do anything in the entire game. I'm trying to not brim over yet. So, like, the ball's going to Dykes. Why is he on the pitch in 90 minutes? I think he headed the ball, like, 3 times and none of them went anywhere near anyone it needed to. Adams missed a chance about 5 minutes in, should have scored, and it's the kind of thing where, like, a really good a player, like, I'm trying to make, how am I not being really harsh to him, a player good enough to play in this tournament would have scored that, because you go through it, you've read it, you read the pace of the ball, where it's going, and you anticipate it and you're going for it. It's almost seemed like the moment you sort of passed him by, almost like he was watching, like he wasn't locked in the game yet. And if he had been, if that had happened maybe in the 50th minute, he might have got it, but 5's too early, he's not got it. So you could say that Billy Gilmore is a big miss, blah, blah, blah. I've only seen him play one full game for Scotland, so I think people going about that, it's, don't worry about it. But he's also very brave in possession, will take the ball in tight spaces like Modric does, turns, and just means that players back off of you, so you've got more space to be able to come out, so you don't have to keep pumping it long to Lyndon Dykes, who didn't do anything. Tierney was good. O'Donnell really wanted him to do well. The problem that O'Donnell had in this game... is again, I don't think he was being as brave as he was against England. He wasn't pushing forward enough. whenever he got the ball, if you watch it back, you'll see every pass he made is immediately to his left, about 5 yards, and then he scampers up the pitch, and no one wants to pass to him in that advanced area, almost like they don't trust his first touch.
Yeah,
which is fair, but then you need to be able to trust everyone. You need to be able to know that you can drive it as hard as you want, and he'll kill it, so you can go with it. They didn't do it. So then straight away, you're limited on the right. Robertson couldn't really get the ball on the left, but the few times he did, he was excellent. He was able to press high and create things. But then you had Stuart Armstrong, who I thought he was wearing like inflatable shoes because he couldn't get the ball under control. You know, sometimes like the ball just won't sit.
Yeah.
And you wonder, like, it just won't get under control.
It's too bubbly.
Yeah, it just didn't sit for him. That happens to you sometimes. It just wasn't his day. But then I would have taken Armstrong off earlier. I would have put on someone like Ryan Crispy. Crispy? Ryan Crispy. Oh, no. I'll remember that one. Ryan Crispy. Ryan Crispy didn't make an appearance. Ryan Fraser came on. He was decent.
How did you see? Get Crispy?
We still have
Fraser.
Fun.
Yeah. I don't know. Ryan Christie. Not Ryan Crispy.
Ryan oh, Fraser. Sorry. I thought you meant Ryan Fraser, but you said Ryan Crispy.
I said Ryan. That would have been far less sense. McGinn was good. McGregor was fine, but again, a little too safe with his passing. Needed to just take it forward a little bit more. It was all just too little. When McGregor scored, I don't know, it was weird. Like, I woke up this morning and I thought, we're going to win this. I've got a good feeling about it. I think we can do
it. You came
it.
Bounding into the office. You were really, really positive.
It's just like Adams, watched it go past him. I thought he was excellent in the game, though, Adams. There's no way he's listening, so he won't care. Right. But yeah, he should have scored that. And then there's a couple other things that just happened that could have gone our way, but I think clearly Crace were just better, much better. And you have to look at the whole tournament, really. Scored one goal. I was worried we wouldn't score a single one before the tournament started. We got one, so that's good.
Watching JJ react to Scotland's equaliser was easily the best moment of the day.
It was nice.
Because we were watching on the TV, and JJ was watching on his laptop just around the corner. And we had about 25 seconds when we knew it was coming. Mm. And you could see his little face. And just, it was great.
It was nice to be able to watch it happening in live time.
It was very exciting for me.
A bit like playing Pokemon Go or something, you know? There's a chancy. Huh? Yeah. A crispy. Okay. Well, that's sad, isn't it? Would you say now, retrospectively, and not to sort of, you know, salt the wounds or anything, but would you say that retrospectively, that first game against the Czech Republic was the real opportunity? Because we spoke about after that game, you felt that they had been a bit too conservative. Seb also thought you were too negative about them after the game, but that's really the one that would have made the difference, right? Because if Scotland had won that game in the way that the Czechs did, you would have ended up in the third game in the situation that they're in, which is not really needing to worry about going through not going through.
I mean, all the hindsight stuff's easy to...
Sure.
Yeah, the cliche of that, but... The weird thing is, like, I watched that game and I thought we were nowhere near good enough. I thought the only time we showed up was against England, but then I also think England were just dreadful and were happy just to take the draw for some reason.
Yeah, sure. Qualification was the reason.
Yeah, yeah. And then the first game, I think there was things he should have done differently. O'Donnell again got hounded out. The one thing I was going to say about O'Donnell, especially, it's not really on the same point, but I think one of the reasons he looked a bit off today, a bit nervous, was because he kept worrying about what Scott McTominay was doing behind him. And sure enough, it was between him and O'Donnell and McTominay were at fault at the back post for the first goal that went in. One of them should have had it. They just a bit of a mix up, cross lines. McTominay's not a centre back. That's what happens. That's what you get. What was the original question? I just don't care.
I was impressed by Scotland. Like, I remember, it's the first time they qualified for a tournament for 23 years. And I thought that, you know, okay, you didn't get the result today. And the Czech Republic game was a little bit of a missed opportunity, I felt, because both those goals were a little bit avoidable.
That's what I was going to say on certainly. That. So on the Czech Republic game is that I thought we were negative, but the XG shows that we'd... Absolutely had the chances.
Should have won the game by a mile. Yeah.
And, if that's a common theme, and I'd imagine it's probably the same. I've not seen the goals tonight. I mean, Croatia will have a greater XG, but I think should have scored maybe more than one. And that's just when you get, it's your striker's fault. If you can see too many, it's often the problem with your goalkeeper or it's something structurally. And then if your XG is, you're not scoring the goals, it's because you're not finishing them. And it's no amount of finishing coaching sessions is going to turn Lyndon Dykes into an international striker. Like, he can, he's there to link the play. The reason he stayed on, I know why, is because you want to keep pumping the ball along to him so he wins it and heads it on and moves it on. And that, I mean, it's entirely obvious why he's on. But you need, I mean, Kevin Nisbet came on far too late as well, a poacher. So you, at some point you need a goal. People always say, oh, just put another striker. I mean, it's all about the structure, how you get the ball into the box in the first place. And probably if you had Gilmore there in the first place, you might be able to do more with it if you'd played Fraser from the start. Just play 3-4-3 or something. Don't play three. Why is there still three at the back when they only, like, they don't need any more goals? Why are you still playing three defenders? Take one off.
What does the next generation look like? What's the next cycle look like for Scotland? Personnel-wise.
Patterson's very good right back. So you start straight away, going to have, like, he's genuinely, I think, really
had someone
good
in the chat asking about him, and he's been connected with Arsenal, which is...
I think he could play that level. maybe getting ahead of myself. I think he could play that level now. I mean, I knew about Tierney for years. Often Scotland players is going to the radar. McGregor could play top six Premier League. McGinn definitely could. And what was I going to say? Yeah, like, I knew Van Dijk could be there. Ayer at Celtic will go there. There's a few players that turn up. David Turnbull is one who could play the Premier League. He's a good player. He's like a 10 or an 8. He's a really good season with Celtic. Patterson, Robertson, Tierney are obviously going to be just there. I like Scott McKenna. He's a centre-back at Nottingham Forest. Played at Aberdeen, but I think he'll keep improving. He was a late bloomer, and I think he'll be at his best when he's about 28, 29.
Okay.
Need a different goalkeeper, I think. I wish Alan McGregor had played in this tournament. It would have made a big difference. I think underneath that, there's still no strikers, really, in this problem. Turnbull's going to be a good creator.
Is there a goal scorer coming through in Scottish football?
Not that I know of. There's a few. There's always some. Like, when you go through, like, Wonder Kids and Football Manager, there's always some that are touted, but they never seem to turn into anything. It's disappointing. Okay. There's none that I know of coming through in Scotland. Not that I know of. It might be escaping me, but I mean, Kevin Nisbet's quite a late bloomer as well. He was playing lower league Scottish football, and he got promoted with his team, went to Hibs last season, and he scored. So he was, like, one of the top scorers in the division lower league. Then he was one of the top scorers in the Premiership. And I think he was linked with a move to somewhere like Birmingham or something like that. And he would do really well, I think, at Championship level. Mm. And could maybe be one of those, like Kevin Phillips or something, that just does manage to score loads of goals weirdly. Or who's that boy at Brighton for ages? Glenn Murray, that sort of player.
Scruffiest centre forward, just score goals forever.
I've heard about one. I think there's this player a little bit older than the norm, but they call him the Bullard, and they're thinking about calling him up to the coaching staff. You know, hey,
yeah.
Would you like me to tell you about the XG in this game? I don't think you're going to enjoy this.
No, tell me what the XG is.
Scotland's XG was 1.61. Mm. Do you want to hazard a guess at what Croatia's was?
Croatia's XG. So ours was 1.61. I would guess 1.8?
0.64.
Oh, come on. Really?
The Modric goal had an XG value apparently of 0.09. The Perisic goal had a 0.06. This is according to soccerblogger.com. Someone else in the chat mentioned that stat too, so I decided to look it up independently. I think it's right.
I feel like that Modric XG should be times by three. I've never seen a player who plays better with the outside of his right foot than Luka Modric. Sure. He makes it look so easy. Like when you watch Luka Modric in real life.
Sorry, JJ slumped back from the microphone and seems entirely dejected. Mission accomplished. Anyway,
should we back off the?
Let's
Modric
back off praise? Scotland now, yeah, let's, and let's you know, let's... we'll talk about them in the future. But very briefly, let's discuss this situation with UEFA in Munich, Seb, which is a bizarre one and kind of got my goat this morning.
Yeah, it's really annoying. So basically, for those who haven't been keeping up, ahead of the next game in Munich, the mayor of the city, Dieter Reiter, made a request to UEFA to light up the Allianz Arena in rainbow colours. It's sure. Pride Month in Germany.
Pride Month.
And UEFA have denied the request because of, quote, the political context it would create and the kind of the opposition it would suggest towards a new law in Hungary that, and I'm reading here, bans the sharing of any content seen as promoting homosexuality and gender change to under 18s. I don't really know what to do with that because I find it, I mean, why? Like what?
It's just stupid.
What are you UEFA? I can't do the mental gymnastics to rationalize that. I don't, No. Help me out. Like I.
Well, all I will say is that I was looking through Twitter earlier, and I think it was Jonathan Harding who tweeted the best tweet about this all day, which summarised my feelings entirely, which was just go on Munich, do it anyway. And I hope they do. I really hope they do.
That's
100%.
Just get people around the world to pay the fine.
I'll chip in for the fine.
Happily. I think it's ridiculous. There's another thing like...
it's disgusting.
The actual UEFA Twitter, I mean, obviously they're not... I mean, social media companies aren't the same as the actual bodies, right? But then the UEFA Twitter was... But last year, maybe 2 years ago, was pointing out someone was trying to call out something to do with why are you doing this for the LGBTQ community?
I saw this.
Yeah. And they said, well, because sometimes you need to stand up for those who need that sort of thing. And now they're, it really winds me up.
So German football has reacted. So a couple of clubs around the country are going to light up their stadiums, not quite in the same way as the Allianz Arena, because obviously that's pretty unique stadium. But they're going to light up their grounds in a similar fashion as best they can. So that's quite nice. But I don't know, there's some strange old tweets coming out of Hungarian government that I've seen on Twitter about talking about sort of common sense and inverted commas. And I just think like, maybe like, I don't have the vocabulary, I don't think.
Put it this way, if we weren't live streaming and or if we, and we
I'm
started
very aware
this live
that we
stream,
are live streaming.
What I'm going to say is if we had started the live stream with a disclaimer on, I would be saying some strong,
pretty punchy
strong
things.
Words about how I feel about this. And as Jonathan Harding said, I hope they do it anyway. That would be fantastic. And in many ways, I guess, would be an even bigger statement. But It's just one of those things that you see, and this happens too often with UEFA, where you read something about something that's happened, and you just feel like, oh, for God's sake.
Yeah, they do make you roll your eyes a bit, don't they? It's
Well, do you know what else makes me roll my eyes? Points, because they're so bad, and I've gained so many of them today, and I almost don't want to do this bit, but let's do it anyway.
Points are bad.
I gained 8 points today. Bad points.
Another sing song? Points are bad.
No, I don't want to sing this song.
JJ.
I'm unhappy.
They're really, really bad.
They are really bad. He thought they were good, and I said,
bad.
You don't want them. They're bad. I am in last place on 70 points now. Okay, I've gained a lot of points, mainly because I have faith in England to score 5 goals, and that was the right thing to do. That was the right decision to make. It's just a painful one. I've made a sacrifice for the country. It's no big deal. No big deal. But I did also gain quite a lot of points.
A moral victory
on the other game.
Points are bad.
I think I said Scotland would win 3-1 as well. So, you know, I got the score line right, but the wrong way around. So, yeah, extra trouble for me. 8 points gain. Seb, we were equal yesterday. You had a great day. You only gained 3 points today. You're on 65.
Nice.
So well done to Seb. He stole my earlier tactic of, say, 1-1 for everything. And it worked out very well for you.
Hey, very, very clever.
Good job. Well done.
Thank you.
JJ, you gained also 5 points today. The same number of points as Alex. So you're just one behind Alex in 60. Alex is on 59. And there's all to play for in Points Are Bad. There's only 11 points separating the worst, which is me, with the most bad points, from Alex, the least bad points.
Well, I gained 5 points. So if I hadn't done that stupid England Euro 96 thing just to be funny yesterday, I'd have been in the lead by miles.
Maybe you were. Also, if you hadn't kept forgetting to make predictions and incurring, I think now, 12 penalty points, would be in the lead by miles.
Can we do predictions today then, so I don't forget?
Yes, we can. The predictions are for this evening before we finish. Tomorrow's game, it's a fun game. Fun game tomorrow. Last day before a couple of days off, and it's going to be a real nice one to round off the first 13 days of the tournament. Let's begin, JJ, with Group E's fixtures of Slovakia versus Spain.
0-1.
To Spain, okay. Mm-hmm. And Sweden versus Poland. The game with all to play for.
1-2.
1 to Sweden, 2 to Poland.
Correct.
Okay, and I'll throw those over to you there. Seb?
I would also take a 1-0 to Spain against Slovakia, but I like Poland to also win 1-0.
Okay.
Over Sweden.
Okay, fine. You're really playing it tight now, aren't you? Because you felt afraid when we were close together.
Points are bad.
Points are bad. What I need to do, actually, is look at the... what's the table look like? I have no idea.
Spain need to win. And everyone needs to win, basically.
Everyone needs to win.
Sweden are probably already through unless they get an absolute pasting because so, they're already in 4 points.
Oh, group it. Yes, they are. So, oh, Spain are on 2 points. Spain have to win.
So, Spain have to win.
And Slovakia, zero goal difference, but probably need a point at least. Okay. In which case, I'm going to say that that result will be 1-1. And Slovakia will make it through. Spain won't make it through. 1-1. Sweden, Poland.
Are you sure I can't interest you in a 4-4?
A 4-4, you say? Yeah, a 4-4. No, come on. Who would do something as crazy as that?
For the country?
3-3, maybe, for the country. But I'm not from Sweden. Sweden? I'm not from Slovakia or Spain. Poland, Sweden. I'm going to say that is it's got classic 0-0 written all over it. Yeah?
8-3.
0-0.
8-3.
8-3? What's happening? The next set of fixtures. Group F, please, JJ. We've got Germany, Hungary. Go.
I want Germany to win this one well.
Okay.
I'm going to say 3-0.
Oh, okay. And that's a weird noise. And Portugal, France. I thought it was in a Carry-On film for a
minute.
Oh, and what'd you say about Portugal, France, JJ?
0-0.
0-0. Oh. Seb, Germany, Hungary, please. Your current homeland versus Hungary.
4-0 Germany.
Yeah, okay. And Portugal, France.
2-0 France.
Oh, all right.
Out you go, Portugal.
Germany, Hungary, I'm going to say 2-0 Germany. And Portugal, France, I am going to say 2-2. 2-2.
So afraid of big numbers all of a sudden.
2-2. That is... Oh. That is the end of the episode. There we go. Goodness me. One more day. We will be live streaming throughout the rest of the month. Every game day, we will be here. But we're about to approach a break day, so you'll be rid of us for a couple of days' time, which is going to be nice.
It's in everyone's best interest.
That it we, really is,
stick away for a couple of days.
I felt sick before this started.
Yes.
And now I feel better, which I think is in great thanks to JJ Bull.
Yep.
You'll come back, won't you, even though Scotland won't?
I'll be back better than ever.
Yeah.
Stronger, with robotic parts.
You'll be here tomorrow.
Yes, and a heart of gold.
A heart of stone.
Yes.
And gold.
Yes.
Because you often find gold inside of stone. And Seb, thank you.
No problem, Joe. Thank you.
Thanks, as usual, to our production team of Don and Sol over there. There's Sol's hand. That's a lovely hand. And we gotta go. See you tomorrow.